Good day, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is 9/03/2002. Today's session is Trauma, Healing Stories from Scripture and Everyday Sacredness. Your presenter is Dr. Nancy C. Reeves, REN 2002-07. Let's listen in.
But Steve, we could start rolling. I'm Nancy Reeves, and this series is called Found Through Loss, Healing Stories from Scripture and Everyday Sacredness. And today we're going to focus on trauma. And I want to start with a poem prayer that I wrote a few years ago. When I was feeling particularly burdened, I'd had a very long day of clients in my psychotherapy practice that were really hurting, and a lot of despair and deep pain, and I was feeling the weight of that. And so I was praying and I was saying, "Jesus, help!" And this is what came. I call it crucial transformation. I welcome. That's a good idea. Yeah. Close the doors if the kids are. Great. Thank you. Crucial transformation. Hate. Choking, stifling, grinding, mocking. You took hate in. Embraced hate, transformed hate into unconditional love, and sent love out to us. Vengeance, desire to degrade, cripple, destroy, make suffer. You took vengeance in, embraced vengeance, transformed vengeance into compassion, and sent compassion out to us. Pain, pounding, cramping, piercing, searing. You took pain in, embraced pain, transformed pain into healing, and sent healing out to us. Despair, feeling abandoned, forsaken, desolated, deserted. You took despair in, embraced despair, transformed despair into salvation, and sent salvation out to us. When the thorns and nails dig in, we can resist and meet violence, or with your help, surrender to metanoia and follow the path that leads to peace. The word metanoia is Greek for a change of heart. And so often, when we're grieving ourselves or when we're hurting for someone else in their pain, the tendency is either to try to keep the pain away from us or to not have any boundaries and have it come in and be overwhelmed. And what Jesus did with the pain was to embrace it and let it go again and allow God's transforming power to change it. So today we're going to talk about the worst possible type of loss, and that's trauma. Trauma is loss with the volume turned way up. We have an experience that we feel we cannot deal with. What often or usually happens is that it's an experience that shatters some assumptions we hold about the world. You know, we'll say, yes, death occurs, and yes, other types of loss occur. But there's some assumptions we may hold. One of the assumptions that a lot of folks after 9/11 would say to me is, I thought that I could work in a particular job, or I could be in a particular place and I'd be safe, or I could keep my family safe. And this is the first time this kind of how violence has really struck home to me, that I can't do that. Now, that assumption never was true. The feeling that if we do a certain thing or we act in a certain way or we're in a certain place, that we are guaranteed to be safe, have no violence touch us. But we kind of live that way. It's almost like nothing can happen to me if I do something. And people are always saying, I wouldn't be in a car accident because I drive defensively, or I wouldn't have this happen because I try to help people and so no one would be angry at me. And then to be hit in the face with the fact that those assumptions don't keep me safe, don't hold weight. It's very scary, and people experience a loss as traumatic. There's common reaction, initial reaction to trauma, which is actually very needed. It's an instinctive response, and psychologists call it the fight or flight response. So I'm walking in a field, it's a beautiful sunny day, all of a sudden I hear a snort behind me, and I look, and there's a bull running fast towards me. I don't stop and say, wonder how I'm going to react. The fight or flight response kicks in. I get a shot of adrenaline and I run faster than I've ever run before. It's not too smart to have the fight response kick in. No, but in some situations it is. Parents have been known to lift cars off their children who've hit them with that surge of adrenaline. So our fight or flight response comes in to protect us in a way that we would not normally do. Our reflexes are much faster than our conscious mind. And that's fine. Now some people freeze, and I put that into the flight response. Sometimes just becoming invisible helps. We see animals doing that all the time, the baby fawn. So this is a normal, healthy response. But if people continue to have their assumptions shattered and feel hopeless about that and feel that they have to control the world themselves, they'll stay in a chronic fight or flight way. And that doesn't help. If I continue to run, I will say, I need to hide from the world. I won't engage with others. Bad things can happen there. I don't trust God. Maybe I believe God's out to get me. I've been punished in this other trauma. And I become despairing and hopeless. I sink into myself. Or if I fight, I try to control. I say, well, I got to do it myself. And I try to control relationships. You know, if you want to be in a relationship with me, you've got to be a certain way. I'll try to control God. I'll put God in a box and say, you know, this is who you are. I may take you out on Sundays and worship you for a bit, but then you go back in the box. I try to control myself. I won't allow myself to change. Both those ways are really unhealthy, and yet the person thinks they're doing it because they have to. That is protection. Tell you about a woman, young woman who had had a lot of trauma in her life, and she had developed a chronic flight mode. And what we often do with our unhealthy patterns is we call them something, and then they sound like they're very reasoned, well thought out, and you know, helping us. So she just said, there's too much loss in the world, it hurts too much to love, so I'm never going to love again. So she went through life limping on all levels, but still thinking that's the only way she could be. And life seemed okay for some time, until she met a man who loved her to her core. And at first, kind of kicking and screaming, she connected with him a bit. She tried to run from him, but he loved her, and the armoring started to come off. And very shortly, she realized that life was better than it had been before. Because of his love for her, seeing who she really was, deep in herself. She could open to him, then open to herself, start to connect with others, and then open to God again. And she thought, the bad time is over. It's gone. But then he was killed. And you'd think she would move back into the flight mode. But there were two things that saved her. And these two things, I think, God gives us that save a lot of people in this situation. The first was she now had a community who supported her and was grieving with her. Not only did she have a community, but in her country, she knew many other women who was in the same situation as her, because the government was very easily threatened and other loved ones disappeared. Other loved ones were taken on trumped up charges and tortured or killed. So she had that sense of solidarity with these other women. She had community. She had this sense of solidarity. She knew that that would help her in her grief. The other thing is that she had now reconnected with God and her faith tradition, and that the rituals would not take the pain away, but would help contain it so that she would be able to tolerate this pain. But when she came to do one of those rituals, which was to help prepare his body, she would be able to say goodbye to him one last time. That's when she panicked, because an assumption was shattered, and she went into fight mode this time. Because when she went to prepare his body, she found that someone had rolled the stone away from the tomb, and the tomb was empty. Mary of Magdala ran to tell her community what had happened. And then she came back, and all she could think of was, I gotta get his body back. She was panicked, she was on her edges. So she looked wildly around and she saw someone whose energy she should have known intimately. But she took him for the gardener. And she said, sir, if you've taken him away, tell me where he is and I'll bring him back. Just gotta get his body back. And it wasn't until Jesus did what? Said her name, called her by name, that she could move from the edges where her panic was, see God, and also see her true self. I think we've all had empty tomb losses in our lives, where because we had our eyes closed, or were running, or fighting, we couldn't see how God was offering us comfort and support and guidance. What God does when we are experiencing trauma is always the same thing. God calls us by name. Because once we move to our true self made in God's image, that's where we can really accept the comfort and the support and the guidance. That's why I think it should be called the Holy Bible, the Grief Therapy Manual. Tell me about empty tomb losses that you've had. Are there anything that you want to ask about that or comment on that story?
I think we've been through one here at Holden with Doug. Yes,
absolutely. Yeah. And where is God in this?
Yeah.
Why aren't we told where Doug is? Why can't we find him?
Besides God speaking in every trauma that I've gone through, I've realized the importance of the compassion and kindness of community.
Yes.
God speaks to us through individuals who come to our support at those times.
Absolutely. You know, it's like a little child you sometimes see sitting on a parent's lap, just screaming, and the parent's arms are around, but the child isn't even feeling that, because they're, yeah. And so God reaches out to us to show us how loved we are and how cherished we are to God by having people come and support. And I think if you think back to some of the real deep losses or traumatic experiences that you've had, that maybe you thought God wasn't there, God wasn't with me. And remember who offered you love and support and comfort and guidance. And often we start to realize how God was there for us, how God got through to us. It might not be a person either. I mean, God will speak to us through nature, through scripture. I want to tell you another story. This was from my practice early on. And I had heard about this couple for weeks. I, for 10 years, was the bereavement outreach coordinator for the Queen Alexandra Children's Hospital. And any weekend or evening or night, I would be called out if a baby or young child died suddenly outside of the hospital when the social workers weren't on. So for 10 years, my experience of either Christmas Day or Christmas Eve was going to a home where they had little stockings saying baby's first Christmas and there being no baby. I had been told about this couple whose baby had died of sudden infant death syndrome and that they were having a really rough time and they needed me, but they weren't calling. And it was our policy not to inflict ourselves on others. They knew where we were, and if they said, yes, please have Nancy call, I'd do so, or if they called themselves, but they weren't saying that. They were saying, no, we don't need any help. So their doctor called, parents of this couple called, friends called, everybody said they're really having a hard time, and I said, yes, I'm sorry, do what you can to support them, but they're not wanting my intervention at this point. But one day, I came out of a session, and my secretary had this big grin on her face, and she said, you'll never guess who just called, and they want you to call as soon as possible. So I phoned, and Bonnie answered the phone, and she said, I'm not calling for me. I'm doing fine. Okay? She said, but our dog, Lucky, is really having trouble. Lucky is peeing all over the house. Her hair is falling out in patches. She's whimpering and whining all the time. She loved the baby, and she would sleep at the foot of the crib, and she's just having a terrible time. And I said, yeah, dogs are very loyal, and they're very upset with death. And she said, so I need a counselor for Lucky. I said, well, actually, I see dogs.
I know their language.
And I said, the thing is, though, that dogs are pack animals. And you can't see dogs alone for counseling. They need to be seen with their pack. Family therapy is really the only way to go with dogs. My husband and I don't need any counseling. She said. I said, that's fine. But in order to support Lucky, so that Lucky doesn't feel that she's being singled out, that she knows you support her, you need to be there too. Now, I was not doing this to try to trick them into therapy. That would be very unethical, right? Real violation. I wasn't doing that. But it's true that I'm sure Lucky was picking up the vibes of this couple and was really having a hard time. And if I just saw Lucky on my own, not a whole lot would happen. So she said, just a minute, and muffled the phone, and I heard her chatting to Chris for a bit, and then she came back on. She said, well, all right, if we don't have to say anything, when would you like to see us? And I said, well, I think I'd prefer to come to you. Lucky would be more comfortable in her own place. I didn't want an incontinent dog in my office. So, I mean, I do have some boundaries. So we set up a time. I knocked on the door and heard a whole bunch of barking, and Chris opened it and said hi and shook my hand, and Lucky came and leaned against me, and I said, big, beautiful golden retriever who looked pretty sorry. Her hair was falling out in patches. She was pretty thin. She obviously wasn't eating well. She looked real anxious, you know, that kind of furrowed brow dogs get. So we went into the living room, and Lucky plopped down in the middle of the rug, and so I sat down beside her. Now, Bonnie sat over here. She brought a chair in from the kitchen and sat as far as she could be away from us. And Chris sat over here on the sofa, and they weren't looking at each other. And I started stroking Lucky and telling her that she was a good dog and that she wasn't to blame for the baby's death, and told her a bit about sudden infant death syndrome, and she started to relax under the warmth of my voice and the petting. And so I said to them, see how Lucky is. And Bonnie said, oh, she's relaxing. She looks much better. And I said, dogs need lots of love and attention. And Chris said, I guess we haven't been giving it to her. You know, it's been kind of a rough time. I said, yeah, I realize that. I said, no, she likes it from me as a stranger. She'd really like it from you. So they said, oh, we can do that. And they got down too, and they were stroking her and telling her what a good dog she was. And I said, could you tell Lucky that she wasn't to blame, that this sadness, this pain is not her fault. And Bonnie said, well, of course not, Lucky. You're a good dog. You loved the baby. You would never have done anything to hurt the baby. And then in a very small voice, she said, I'm to blame. I'm the mom, and I should have known. And Chris stopped stroking Lucky and looked at her and said, you're to blame. I thought you were blaming me. I was to go and pick him up for his 2 o'clock feeding and bring him to you. But when he was quiet, I thought, oh good, my wife's going to get to sleep through tonight, and I didn't go, and maybe. I thought you were blaming me. And she said, blaming you? How could I blame you? You're such a wonderful dad. It's me, because the mother should know. And then Chris said, but remember they told us about SIDS, how a baby could die in a doctor's arms? Like, if a baby's going to die, you can't do anything. And she said, so you don't want a divorce? He says, how could you think that? He reached out to her, and, you know, I teared up, and Lucky got up and went and got a squeaky toy. It's all good. The problem's resolved. And so they kind of held hands and cried with each other for a bit, and then we decided that was enough for today and left. And so I saw the pack for 3 more times. Lucky stayed very briefly with us, and then off she went. She didn't need to be there anymore. So, I see God working very strongly through that little dog. Was reaching out to them in all sorts of ways, but they, in their trauma, in their guilt, where they were sure the other was blaming them and was just waiting for someone to bring up that divorce word, they couldn't hear how God was getting through it. And so the dog helped. Have you had experiences like that where a child or an animal will speak for God, show the problem what needs to be done? The reaction to trauma, we talked about the fight or flight response, but there are 3 categories that people will find themselves in with a traumatic experience. So say an earthquake suddenly happened here, and a really big earthquake. 10 to 25% of us would be calm, cool, and collected. We'll have a shot of adrenaline, but it would move us into a fight mode that helped ourselves and others. Okay? So we'd be the calm ones, and we would say to the others, you know, stay away from the windows, you know, like stand under the doorways or move where, you know, it's more, and that's great. 50 to 75% of us would be confused, we'd be kind of sheep-like, we would take direction from these calm ones, but we wouldn't be thinking clearly ourselves. We'd be more likely, if we were told to God, oh, I gotta get my papers, you know, and we'd be doing kind of habitual things like that. 10 to 25% of us would get quite hysterical. We would not do what we were told. We'd, you know, run around, we'd grab people, we'd you know, go towards danger maybe, away from others, away from safety. Now, I know this could add up to more than 100%, but it's a range. Now, if the earthquake happened, which group would you be in? Which group would you want to be in? First one, right. Well, sorry, the 10 to 25% of us would be in that group.
That's what I was when we had the quake in Seattle last year.
Yes.
Yeah, I was in the classroom and every kid went underneath their desk like they're supposed to.
Yeah.
I can't believe it.
Wow. Yeah. And which one were you in?
I was calm. I just said, my goodness. And yeah.
And we like it if we're in the calm group, right? Because we see ourselves as helpers and we see, but we can't all be in that group.
I had a really different experience. Same earthquake, same day.
Yeah.
I was the principal of the school in Bellevue and the shaking started when I was talking to the nurse by my door.
Yeah.
And so she headed down the hall to get under her desk. I scooted around, got under my desk, and the shaking just seemed to go on and on. And the more it went on, the more worried I got.
Yes.
And then it hit me, you're the principal. They're going to be wanting you to show the way here. But for the life of me, I just had the hardest time getting it together.
Yes.
And then my counselor, it was this little boy that we'd both been working with who was a pretty troubled kid, little six-year-old. And she came by my office with him in her hand.
Yeah.
Because the shaking by then had stopped and we were going to evacuate. And she said to him, Joey, I want you to go get Mrs. Henderson.
So she's the call.
So Joey came, so they came. And so here we are. She's got me by one hand, Joey's got me by the other hand, and they're leading this principal out to the playfield. And in that time of just that time it took us to get out of the building, I got myself together and could do the stuff that a principal was supposed to be doing during this earthquake. But it was an interesting experience for me because I was so thankful to her, and I was also thankful to that little boy because he had full confidence. He had the counselor in one hand, the principal in the other. What could possibly go wrong? How did he know?
That's wonderful. What puts us in one of these? It could just be like maybe we're having a bad hair day, right? And we move into hysterical. Like there's not always some deep psychological meaning for why we're in one of these. Sometimes the people with the most training spaz, you know? And so what happens is I have a contract with our provincial government. If there's a trauma, community trauma in some community on Vancouver Island, I'll go in and be the team leader for the psychological response, and I'll get the helpers, the lay helpers, and the professionals working together. And I'll often go in and I'll say, okay, this is, you know, the where you would have, the categories you would have been in. Who is in the calm category? So maybe it's I've gone into social service agency, and one of the clients has come and pulled a knife on the receptionist trying for money for drugs, and you know, it's so real scary for everybody. So I'll say, who is in the calm section? Well, they'll look over to a few people, right? You know, and I'll say, okay, you're out of a job. You know, because what's going to happen is you're going to be pedestalized. And they won't let you act in any other way from now on. You are the calm one, and it generalizes too. They start asking your advice on all sorts of other things. You know, you happen to be calm when that knife was pulled, so now they're saying, You know, I'm thinking about retirement, and I'm wondering what kind of funds, you know, they just generalize, you know, like, what kind of shaving cream should I put on? Like, I'm expecting the first time one of those firefighters from New York doesn't pay alimony or is in a car accident that they caused, it's going to be on the front page. Because our heroes are not supposed to have clay feet. You know, it feels good to put them on that pedestal. Well, that's the person in our school or agency or what that we could always rely on. Good. Don't think about it anymore. So I say to them, you're out of a job. It's not that you have to now fall apart, but if you want to, you go for it. But you're off the pedestal. And no one else rely on them anymore about this trauma. They need time to enter into their own reactions and work through that. I've had more chiefs of police and fire and all of that burning out, coming to see me with post-traumatic stress disorder because they say, I feel I've been living a lie for years. Like early on in my career, I did something and I was the hero and maybe I even received a medal for it. And I've been trying to live up to that ever since. No one ever lets me have feelings of being scared or despairing or lonely. And so I've just pushed down all those feelings for years. And now I'm, you know, chief of police, but, you know, I just dread any more trauma. I can't take it anymore. So I say to them, you're out of a job. Now, who were the confused ones, the sheep? Well, yeah, we were. They all said, okay, you're out of a job now, too. You've done that. Who knows why you've done it, but you have. Now, would you like to start taking charge? Well, yeah, okay, you start doing it. Because these ones that are calm, cool, collected, they're not going to lead you anymore. Not around this one. Now, in another one, you might be in that first. Okay. Then I say, okay, who are the hysterical ones that really spazzed? Well, they all look away from a few. So, you know. I said, okay, you guys are out of a job unless you like that role. And again, who knows why you were there? It could have been that you just had so much stress in your life at that moment that you just couldn't take anymore. It could have been a personal meaning. There could be lots of reasons. It doesn't mean you're going to automatically do that again, but they're labeling you and you're labeling yourself as the incompetent one in a crisis. Right? And I bet you, I'll say to these social workers, I bet you you're all thinking of becoming plumbers, right? Said, you're out of a job too. If you want to start helping with the mop-up, go for it. And you others, don't feed into the myth that they're not competent. They spazzed at that one particular time. But do they have any good skills as social workers? Well, sure. Yeah, they do. And people say, okay, well, those are still there. Use them. And what was starting to be an agency that was isolating some, you know, was lifting up others and was, you know, it starts to be more cohesive and more mutual. So it's really important to realize that if we feel shame or embarrassment about a way we've dealt with crisis in the past, that it's so important not to label ourselves forever with that. Be able to shift away from it. Does that ring any bells from experiences that you've had in the past? I mean, that was a great one. Sometimes it's the little child, right, that would... I read one, it was, I think, a tornado in Australia that had really damaged a mental institution. And the big issue was that a number of the patients, particularly the schizophrenic patients, were calm, cool, and collected in that crisis. And a lot of the psychiatrists and psychologists just spazzed. And they were so ashamed to go back in again that a lot of them took sick leave right after. But they luckily had someone who could call them up and say, we're having a meeting, you've all got to come. And, you know, it's part of your, if you want to have your funding for your sick leave, you've got to come to this. And they talked about this. And they were able to go in, and because they said, but the patients were, yeah, They were. Yeah. And in talking to some of the schizophrenic patients, they said, well, it didn't seem a whole lot different than my normal life. Any comments or questions about this?
The situation with Doug here reminded me early in my career when I was a church camp director. We had a kid that wandered off from camp, and I was in the confused category, never dealt with that before. And fortunately, there was an older, wiser, happened to be a spouse of a staff person that were there with mentally retarded kids, and he just took charge of the whole search.
Yeah.
And I felt, you know, I really put that label on myself, and for years said, I'm not competent to be a camp director. If I can't, you know, because I tend to live with a sense of, you know, you plan for the worst and pray for the best. But,
yes.
But that was something I had not planned for, right, and had not figured out in advance. I was totally confused by it, and felt totally incompetent for years after that. Because, you know, again, a little bit like the principle, you know, when you're supposed to be sitting at the top and being the pedestalized person, self-imposed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because I don't have any recollection of anyone looking at me like I was a bad camp director.
Right. Right.
But it was also because I was blessed to have that gentleman step forward, and Gene said, I'll, and he just organized the whole thing. And and I crawled under the blanket, literally. I went back to my place and just said, what am I doing here? It's
yes.
just incredibly confusing, awful time.
I've got to do it alone,
yeah.
or I have to do it in a certain way. Yeah. And I think, I mean, a great role model for us is Jesus, who didn't need to have all of these followers, particularly the followers he chose, but did. Let them support him, let them comfort him, let them wash his feet, let him do them do things to help him. It wasn't that he said, I don't need that. You do that for each other, but you don't need to give it to me. No, the good helper is, like we were talking last night in the evening meeting, the wounded healer. We need support.
A 9/11 story?
Yes.
A girl who was raised on a farm near Early, Iowa, was working in the second building that was hit. When the first building was hit, everything fell off their desks. And the boss, whoever that was, said, now just remain calm. And they all started picking up their desks and they were remaining calm. And she said, I smell diesel and I'm leaving.
Mm-hmm.
Is anybody going with me? And one person went with her.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they left, and they went down all those many, many stairs, mm-hmm. and they got out. So remaining calm is not always the best.
Exactly, it may not be. That's right. And it's sometimes in our hysteria that lets us lift the car off the child. You know, if we were just calm and cool, like, there's no way we could do that.
Right.
Yeah. And that's where that initial reaction with the adrenaline surge, if we can let it inform us, let it, you know, take us over, we often do what's right. Yeah, that's a great story. Thank you.
So distinguish a little more then between the calm hysterical thing, because
yeah, okay,
that puts another overlay on what
it, it does. I think with the fight or flight response, if we go with that and we don't try to push it away or shut it down, it will either have us fight in a calm way, not in a way that's destroying others, right? Or to run or leave or freeze, because that's going to be most protective. And we can look calm while we're doing that, you know, because we haven't, where this one, where we're hysterical, it's like we let go of ourselves. We do like Mary did. We get to our edges where we can't see clearly. Here's Jesus standing right in front of her and she can't see that, and it's obvious to everybody else but not to her. So we can be here and be kind of very forceful and fighting, or we can, you know, freeze, or we can, if that's what's important. Sometimes people just say stop before we do anything. Let's just stop and listen and smell and see, okay, I smell diesel, we need to go. You know, I would see it that calm place. With the confused, we're just not thinking clearly. We're not usually doing anything that's going to hurt someone else. And we're very easily directed. Here, you can't be directed. You've lost yourself. Is that?
Well, let me just push this story. I think it's a useful story because the calm person who said, okay, let's get stuff back on the desk.
Yeah.
If the person who smelled diesel was hysterical.
Yeah.
And said, I smell diesel, let's get out of here. I mean, it's still...
It would still be that they were...
directive.
They're right, yeah.
And then the confused ones have to make a choice. Am I going to go with the calm directive or am I going to go with the hysterical directive?
Yeah.
The male in me, which tends to try to be in control, would go with the calm directive.
Right.
I don't like hysterical people.
Mm-hmm.
And I tend to discount all the time what they say,
yeah.
even though it may be accurate.
Yeah, for sure. And it may not, people can lead you into all sorts of dangerous situations mm-hmm. if they have this calm demeanor, right? And that's where, now it's really awkward to say this because I do not want to imply in any way that people who died in the Twin Towers were not hearing God. But we spent last week looking at spiritual discernment and how often our God directs our attention to where we need to go or what we need to do. And if somebody, for example, cultivates a calm response, but is not really in touch with the reality of a situation, okay? It could be if I calm down and I really listen and I really smell and I really see and I'm really present to my experience, something says, God somehow gets through and says, leave. But if I take it over, if I decide I'm going to be calm, but I'm not open to my environment, I'm not open to God, then I would move into that other role. Does that
mm-hmm.
kind of, yeah. But I'm not saying that the people who didn't leave were not good discerners. We don't know why some people died, but we know God was with them.
I was in Seattle with that earthquake 2 years ago, and our director ended up, we were in the Pioneer Square area, which is the old part of town, and he was standing there asking that all of us get out of the building.
Mm-hmm.
Our buildings are old, and we were out on the streets and buildings were falling around us. And I said, turn, I thought it was better for us to stay in the building than stand there and watch walls falling down.
Yes.
He was very adamant that we all get out of the building.
He was into the policies and procedures of the escape plan,
The escape plan. And I was on the phone and I was still talking to a friend and he said, put the phone down, we gotta get out of here.
Yeah, yeah.
And I stood there, I got out, and we were watching bricks falling around.
Yeah. And one of the best advice I ever heard was, when you're in a crisis, don't move for a second or two. Try to stop and be as present as possible to the experience before you make the decision to go. But so often, to try to protect ourselves, we move into the escape plan, or we move into, the way we've done it before that's helped us, or something.
The calm people, are they denying the situation sometimes?
Usually the adrenaline makes them fight in a way that kind of calms them down and really focuses them on what needs to be done. At that point, they can't afford to take in the meanings and implications of what's happening, right? So somebody will see a friend who has just been in a terrible accident, blood all over the place, and they don't say to themselves, oh, my friend is really injured. You just say, need to stop that bleeding, right? So that, at that time, is needed, is healthy. But if they stay in that place, they won't work through that. They need later to be thinking back and going, oh my God, my friend could have died, and shake with the reaction and let it out of their system. Because yes, it is making a decision to focus on one aspect of the trauma and not the rest. And if we really want to integrate it and let it go, we need to to move back into that. But that's not the time. Like I always say to people, because they say, oh, you know, in psychotherapy, when I'm seeing them, you're so calm and it's so helpful to talk. I wish you were there during my car accident. I say, the last thing you needed in your car accident was somebody sitting there saying, how do you feel about it? You needed those rescue people who didn't care how you felt, who got you out of the car before it caught on fire. And you know, so does that kind of answer what you were asking?
I think so, but you know, I also am thinking of the less traumatic situations. I'm a congregation president. Mm-hmm. Our church is between pastors right now. We have an interim pastor. And as we get closer to the actual call process, I can sense the anxiety level in the congregation rising again. Yes. So it's part of my role to help keep that calm.
Mm-hmm. Maybe, because if their anxiety could have words, so you could see what their needs are, then by meeting the need, the anxiety diminishes. So sometimes the anxiety can be very helpful to just stay with and give it words. I think one reason we decided to have the sheets of each day of the search for Doug and let people write on them, and it wasn't that powerful last night during Vespers, was to give their anxiety an outlet. So many people said, I didn't go on the search because physically I'm not able to do that. And, you know, I was praying for him, but, you know, I didn't know if that was enough. And so we said, well, give a voice to the concerns, the issues. And so many people, adults and children, wrote on those. And then by telling the story all together, I think it allayed a lot of people's anxieties. So sometimes it is... calmness is not needed in that way. Like, no, a calm exploration. You don't want to get hysterical in the anxieties. But, because there's a difference, and a lot of people don't realize this, between fear and anxiety. When I'm in that field with the bull, I am afraid. I'm even terror. And I get the shot of adrenaline and I run. Then I get over the field and I go home. And I start telling the people in my life about what happened. And I feel another surge of anxiety, or of adrenaline. And I think I'm afraid, but I'm not afraid, I'm anxious. Because there's no direct danger there. The bull is not in my house. So this is anxiety rather than fear. Now anxiety is there for a specific purpose. To say, remember, don't go into a field again like that, or don't, you know, tangle with a bull the next time you might not live. And if I change my behaviors, maybe my attitudes, and I'm very careful, I don't go into fields, or I really check out, then the anxiety has done its job and it moves off. But so often we don't, we just try to get rid of the anxiety, maybe through medication or something, or we don't listen to it, and it continues, and it continues, and it just gets worse because it's trying to get our attention. Sometimes, too, our anxiety coming from our subconscious is not really understanding the situation. Because I get a lot of people coming to me who've been in a car accident who are anxious every time they go in a car again. Well, you can't, in this society, very easily say, I'll never be in a car again. So what I do with them is to take them out in a car and teach them different anxiety reduction, relaxation techniques, but I also teach them how to be safe in a car, you know, safer than they were before, how to be vigilant, but not hypervigilant, watchful, but not, you know, traumatized. And what that does is it gives a message to the subconscious that, okay, I've heard you. Thank you for your warning. Yes, I know cars can be dangerous, but not all cars are dangerous at all times. So this is what I'm doing to keep myself safe. So there's ways of dealing with the anxiety if it continues, but it really means giving it a name. What are we anxious about? What are we afraid is going to happen if we don't get the right pastor or whatever that is. And then going through an intentional process of change. Because everybody has their own way of going through change, and a lot of us don't do change well. We want things to stay the same. So I don't know if that kind of speaks
to you. That's helpful.
Yeah.
Thank you. One of the things that I found in my life, and I don't know how many can relate to this, is I'm the third child in a family of good dysfunctional family. And so I'm born into this family, watching all these older people carry on this dysfunction, and yet coming through, I grow more and more silent as I watch it and grow up, and I become probably somewhat of the lost child or the silent child watching this, but yet having very little confidence in what I've seen. So somehow I'm going to have to come out into the world and build or get communicated with confidence. And this is a trauma in itself, and it's a long lasting trauma.
Yes.
It is, you know, some traumas are over like that, and mm-hmm. some traumas are a lifetime mm-hmm. or 20 years of living in a home. And so you come out and you run across these people, older people, all of your life, who will take charge.
Oh, they love to take charge.
Yes, they're right there to take charge of you.
Yep.
And yet you see a sense of reality that things, you've got a whole past log of things that haven't worked out, so you're very leery of anybody taking charge of you.
Yes.
And I think that there's kind of like maybe two groups. Soloway has written a book, Born to Rebel, uh-huh. and he's the Harvard scholar. He's taken like 3,000 biographies, and he's taken what the older born and the later born, and he's mapped them out as to how they will react, who will be in a revolution and who will not be in a revolution, what a later born will do and what an older, and so you really, it's hard to listen to yourself. You know, you're...
Yes, it, yes.
See, I live in a building where there... Bullion Hall, where there was an earthquake. And I have to say to myself, now, God speaks to me in a sense. And,
yes.
And I have to go with myself, even if I get in trouble.
Sure,
I have
yes.
to go with myself, even if I get into trouble. And I think that older people around don't realize that you, us younger ones, have to do that because we have a relationship with God. And we don't know when our day is to die. It might be that our day is to die that day. And then again, it may not be, because we saw on September 11th that there were a lot of people who didn't show up. There were only 5,000 people in that building.
Yeah.
And I, as the youngest one, would probably get sick and decide not to go to work. But if I were my brother, I wouldn't miss a day. I'd be right there, and I'd be intimidated if I weren't right there on that day.
So if we can cultivate flexibility, too, that we're not, we just don't follow a particular pattern all the time.
Yes, and God's voice may say, well, total responsibility is not where it's at. I have a different plan for you today, you know. And because there were so few people in that building that it was uncanny that they didn't show up.
And a lot of people got out, too. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people got out.
Yeah.
So.
That's right. And we, last week we spent, you know, the time looking at spiritual discernment, you know, how to know God's will for us. And in the study that...